back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We're going to be taking the Maryland Crab Cake Tour back out on the road. We'll have full details on all that. We'll be giving away some Maryland Lottery scratch-off Ravens tickets to get you on that Jacksonville trip, as well as our friends at Window Nation and Goodwill. I'm sporting my Goodwill shirt today because they do great jobs programs around town. And this segment is going to be kind of all over the place. I got to know Thomas Dolby a little bit as a local mate when he came over. It's been a number of years now, almost going on a decade, that if you see a guy that looks like Thomas Dolby on a bike somewhere in East Baltimore, it probably is. He has been a professor here and working here and running into him at music events and around town. But when the Rams head folks got to me, Laura Price, my dear friend, said, "We're putting this Todd Rundgren thing together." And I said, "Rundgren, Bowie, check, yes. I wonder if Thomas Dolby, oh, he's on the bill." So I said, I'm going to reach to Thomas and catch up with him. It's been a plague since we've been together, Thomas. How are you, my friend?
I'm actually very well, yeah. The plague, which is miserable for a lot of people, I think I was one of the better ones, better off ones. You know, I kind of like living like a hermit. So it sort of works okay for me. And actually, you know, my course lends itself quite well to going online, although it's great to be back now with real people with no masks and so on.
A friend of mine was a student up at Berkeley, and during the beginning of the plague, she put together her classmates doing Burt Bacharach's symphony of What the World Needs Now is Love, Love Sweet Love. It was featured like all over the world, hundreds of millions of hits, sensation. She was honored with Bacharach, the President Biden, like the whole deal. And it all came from music in separate rooms, right? I remember like Elton John had that separate rooms thing with Bernie Taupin, and they wrote songs. But music now, bands get together and do this. The plague sort of brought the music world into a new space of technology, and even artists like yourself rethinking old works. I mean, solitude's good for art type people sometimes to get in the laboratory and create, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think creative people thrive on adversity. You know, it's like when you have things stacked against you for whatever reason, it sort of forces you to dig deep and come up with a new way to get creative. And so from that point of view, I think it was good for collaboration, you know. But I think among musicians, there's really no substitute for sitting around in the campfire with your guitars, you know, and sort of, you know, banging on things and just that real-time interaction is really crucial. So I think it was hard for a lot of us, but I think we're very adaptable. I think, you know, we make use of technology when it's available, and we use it and all the tools at our disposal to adapt when times are hard.
Well, you were always a guy about technology on the front end, and not just the song and science and playing the role of professor and whatnot, but you come here honestly to work with people, not just young people, but lots of different kinds of people. I've seen you in various workstations here with more than a keyboard and symphonies and doing things that are forward thinking for music and for education. Literally, that's what you do. Tell everybody what you do, because, you know, I Googled up, you know, what is Thomas Dolby doing now? And it pops up and it talks about professor and here and studying and Johns Hopkins. But run our audience through, and we'll get to Bowie and we'll have a good time and do a Live Aid reunion and all that, but what are you doing? Because I think you're doing has incredible value here, and you're a citizen of Baltimore now. I always feel responsible for you, Thomas. I hope that you're having a good time here, you know?
I'm having a great time, actually. I love it here. And Baltimoreans say, really? But I love it here. So there's two main roles, Nestor, that I have here. You know, one is a professor of music at the Peabody Institute, which is Johns Hopkins University, where I teach film and game music. And the other is as the chairman of the Living Classrooms Foundation music program. I'm sure you know all about Living Classrooms. It is an after-school program based out of their headquarters on Fayette Street with the Under Armour house there, which is a community center that Under Armour helped them convert a few years ago. And we designed a little studio to go in there so that kids could get their hands on musical instruments, you know, after school, and adults as well. Less than 50% of Baltimore City kids have any music education at all these days. And of those, I think about 15-20% get to play an instrument. And this is just insane. I mean, it's been proven for years, and we all know instinctively how good music is for our kids, not just, you know, for having fun and jamming with their friends, but also for, you know, their learning, their cognitive skills in general, collaboration, creativity. Music, you know, should really be a part of the curriculum. But I think, you know, when budgets are short, I think it's one of the first things to go. And it's just very sad that, you know, less than half Baltimore City school kids get to experience music of any sort. So at Living Classrooms, we went out and got the funding to provide an after-school program, which enables kids to come in and play instruments, to learn how to make beats on computers. They end up with a SoundCloud page or a YouTube. You know, they make their own little performance videos with vocals and rapping and things that they put on YouTube. And they have regular performances there at the Fayette Street Center. So it's been a great you know, a great honor really for me to be involved in such a cool organization. And I think that, you know, one of the great things about Baltimore, which you don't get in big cities, and I've lived in many of them, but most people I know are involved in the community and trying to make things better one way or another. And if you live in London or New York or, you know, Los Angeles, most people you meet are looking after number one. Right. And if you happen to mention that you're involved in an after school program or you coach kids soccer or whatever, people go, right, see you later, you know. And
it's a bit of a social obligation here with your neighbors, right? Much more so than maybe not as much as in a small town, but we've always proud of Charm City, right? I mean, we look after each other, and the murder statistics and all of that aside, the people I know have been looking after me my whole life. It's why I'm here 31 years later, right? Like, we look after each other, and we do embrace folks like you, you know, over here, and try to get you a crab cake and take you to a Ravens game and make you a part of the fabric of East Baltimore, right?
Well, I mean, you know, it's great to have like a mixture of different strokes. I still feel like an outsider here some of the time. You know, I'm not from here. I'm from a very different culture, but I can bring something to the table that maybe a lot of these kids have not experienced, you know, in the past. So yeah, Living Classrooms is, you know, one of my roles. The other is as a professor at Johns Hopkins, which is a fantastic program that we started 5 years ago. It's a 4-year undergraduate degree in film music and game music. We have a lot of kids that want to be film composers or game music composers, you know, when they get out into the workforce, or producers. There's a whole realm of jobs in media for musicians. It's one of the few sources of income for musicians these days. So hard to make a living from streaming, live work, etc. So yeah, well, we train composers to get out there, you know, to Hollywood, to New York, to get involved in films and media and game composition and so on. And it's a fantastic program, the only one of its kind in the country. You know, typically you do this at master's, not at undergraduate level. And we have a very smart group of kids, about 40 currently. The program is really growing, and I've built it up over the last few years. The first cohort of students graduated in the spring, and they're already working. Four of them took a lease together on a house in the Hollywood Hills, and they're out there working as composers. It's fantastic.
Look at how you're beaming about your children, your students. Thomas Dolby is here. It is always poetry in motion when he's with us. He lives here in Baltimore. He and I haven't been. It's been a plague since we've gotten together, but we have gotten together in the past and talked music in this David Bowie assignment down at Maryland Hall, down in Annapolis with our friends from Ramshead and Todd Rundgren. And I want to get to all that, but I want to stay on Baltimore with you and a couple of things, and then I want to get to London. I have all sorts of things to get. You're working with young people who have desire on the streets of Fayette Street, a block from the post office and the former Carmelo Anthony space, where you know, Kirk Lee used to sweep the floors there after playing in the NBA and playing overseas. So I'm very familiar with that. Now you're working with other people that you're selecting the best of the best, right? So I mean, you're really working with a wide variety of artists. I just would say, and that's aspiring, just different. You're mixing and matching quite nicely here. You have two different lives, right?
Absolutely. But you know what's amazing about this for me, Nestor, is that when I was 18, 19, there were no programs like this. You know, I was in London, you know, there was very academic sort of university courses available. I'm from a very academic family. My father was an Oxford professor. My mother taught statistics, and I wanted to study experimental film and electronic music. You know, there's nowhere for me to do that. So I never went to college. In fact, I must be one of the only professors at Johns Hopkins that, you know, barely got through high school, let alone, you know, having a PhD.
You've probably read a few books, though, on the side, Thomas,
I've read a few books, and I've sort of been out there and done it. And I think that universities these days, you know, like to have professors of the practice, as they say, you know, who have been out there and done it in the real world, and, you know, to balance with the more sort of academic instructors. But yes, I mean, I've tried to create here the kind of program that I would have liked to have had when I was college age that didn't exist then. And it's a pioneering program. But, you know, I think if you're a teenager, if you're 18 and you're convinced this is what you want to do for a vocation, you know, why wait till you're in your mid-20s to get stuck into it as a specialty? You know, so in 4 years, we've sort of crammed the right skills and tools, you know, into the program that you can come out at 22, 23 and hit the ground running.
Let's talk about the beginning of this, because you talk about living classrooms, which is near and dear to my heart, and James Bond. I miss Maritime Magic this year. The weather was kind of cruddy a couple of Fridays ago, but the band's always great. The food's always great. Highly recommend that anybody goes to livingclassrooms.org and learns more about the great work that they do there. But for you, when you've talked about 18, 19, and you've told me that story a few times, that this program would have been a draw for young Thomas Dolby to be a part of. What about when you were a kid? Were you 4 years old, mother taking you proper to get a piano lesson? Or like, how did it happen for you? Because your music, and much like, and we can move this into Bowie and talk a little bit about music and experimental music. And now that Bowie's all over, and I've gone to Brooklyn and seen the exhibit and like all of that stuff. And I think, you know, I had interviewed Bowie one time, and I'll make fun of myself for not knowing your role in Live Aid, which I'll also get to here, and we'll have a laugh. But your music, when I heard it on MTV, there was the new wave, the British thing, the post Sex Pistols and Ramones, and here comes the Clash, and, you know, maybe Modern English. And I listened to some Modern English this morning, by the way. But your music was not rock, or it was synthy and it was experimental, but I don't know where it came from. I mean, and it probably came much like what you're trying to do with beats with these kids, but did it come from a recorder? Did you have a clarinet as a kid? How did it all begin?
I used to bang on the kitchen implement. You know, I get out the kitchen ladles and bang on them, and that was about it.
You were a percussionist early on.
Yeah. I was forced to sing in a choir when I was at boarding school in England, you know, and so I learned very fundamental sort of, you know, music theory from that, but I never studied formally. It's mostly self-taught. You know, a lot of the musicians I know don't read or write music. It's not essential. You know, to working as a musician, it's a pretty good idea if you want to go into film work. You know, it's like I did scored some movies myself, and I kind of, at that point, that was the one time that I really wished that I'd learned about orchestration and, you know, notation and things like that. But no, I mean, it's not essential. You know, music is really, really is a universal language, and most musicians I know sort of teach each other on the fly. They look at what they're doing, they use their ears. And, you know, using your ears and your intuition is what I try and teach these students, because in a way that's a more vital skill than the sort of, you know, conservatory skills that sort of teach you 200-300 years of rules, you know.
Well, a guy who had no rules was David Bowie. So I'm going to tell my David Bowie story, which is a pretty good David Bowie story, as David Bowie stories go. And then you're going to tell yours, which is going to blow mine away. But I just want to say this. I discovered David Bowie on MTV, like most people, and, you know, fashion and videos, and then working backwards. I had a cassette tape, two cassette tape, greatest hits, 1980, 81, discovered Hunky Dory, Scary Monsters, like all of that stuff, the videos, the non-videos, Ziggy, Diamond Dogs, all of that. And then I somehow became a music critic as a kid, sort of Cameron Crowe-ish, 1984, 85, 86. I sat up for 3 nights camping out with my friend Ron Zukowski, who you dined vegetarian with, as I remember, camping out for David Bowie tickets on the Sirius Moonlight Tour. Saw the shows, front row, had tickets, the whole deal, had a great time. And then later, 6 years later in life, he formed Tin Machine, and I wound up interviewing David Bowie because his publicist was Reeves Gabral's wife at the time, who's now in The Cure. So I wound up interviewing David. It was lovely. It was nice. Met him. Had a meal. It was a beautiful thing. I have this great conversation with David Bowie that's available at BaltimorePositive.com. You can just put it in. That's my David Bowie story. So I meet you, and I told you, hey, I interviewed Bowie once, and I figured you'd played with him or knew or from the right side of the pond and certainly the right era. But I had no idea that you were like the conductor in the Live Aid thing. So pick the story up, because because your story is way better than mine. But where's the first time you heard David Bowie's music? Because you're a little older than me. And I'm thinking, like, you were a fan, and that Live Aid thing must have meant the world to you at that moment as well. And now you're recreating this music with Todd Rundgren, and it's going to be a beautiful thing you guys are doing later on in the month down in Annapolis.
You know, it's hard to emphasize enough how important Bowie was to my generation, you know, growing up. It was about the music. It was about the fashion. It was about the androgyny. You know, he broke all the rules. And so from the mid-70s, myself and many of our friends were complete disciples of David Bowie. So fast forward to, you know, 1985, He was invited to play at Live Aid. It was just another gig to him at the beginning. He was in the middle of shooting a movie, Labyrinth, at Pinewood Studios. And he didn't have much time to put into it because he was working all day on the film. And his regular touring band were away in the USA. So he asked me and Kevin Armstrong, who was the guitarist in Tin Machine, who's a longtime collaborator of mine, to put together a backing band for him a week later to perform at Wembley at Live Aid. And we only had him for like three evenings of rehearsals, about 4 hours apiece.
So had you met him at this point or no?
I'd never met him.
Oh my gosh.
And the weird thing was that, you know, I expected him to be a bit of a diva, quite frankly. You know, I'd seen, there was a BBC documentary called Cracked Actor, which is about him when he was at his most strung out, you know, in the back of a 30-foot limousine, you know, describing himself as a fly in a carton of milk, and looking like, you know, death, quite frankly. And I expected him to be a little bit like that. But in fact, he was an amazing gentleman in real life. He sort of breezed into the room and he just exuded wonderfulness. And although he plays multiple instruments, he never told us what to play. He would just sort of inspire us to be at our best. And as I said, he kept changing his mind about what songs he wanted to do. He was going to do four songs. He started out thinking he was going to promote his current single, which was Loving the Alien. You know, not one of his best known songs. But as he got more zeroed in on the event, he realized it was a global thing. It was going to have a huge TV audience, more than 1 billion people watching on TV, 120,000 at Wembley. And so he realized it was about playing the hits, the anthems. So he kept changing his mind about what to do. And fortunately, because the group that we put together all worshipped his music, you know, if he said, oh, let's try Rebel Rebel, Kevin would just go... and we just knew it, right? So it was a fantastic thing. But the four songs that we eventually did at the gig, we'd never played them back to back in rehearsal. We played them each, but we never played them as a set. And in fact, right before we walked on stage, he changed his mind again and said, let's start with TVC15. And I'm like, because it starts with a sort of honky-tonk piano solo, which is really not my thing.
I love that song, too.
I had to kick that off.
Thomas, but, I watched that on July 13th during the plague, right? Because it was the 35th, and I was at the Philadelphia show. So mm-hmm. I watched you on television in Philadelphia, and then, you know, I had the DVD. And I watched it, and you were conducting on the stage. And I like did a moment back because I know I had talked to you about it and you're not the type to tell these stories, you know, at a cocktail event. But I turned back to my wife and I'm like, he didn't tell me. I said, next time I get him on, he's going to have to tell me. Because you did tell me this lovely story about taking a helicopter ride with him in, right? Because there was no way to get to Wembley, right?
Well, I mean, this came up again, because I don't know if you saw the Queen movie, Bohemian Rhapsody, a few years ago. And in that, they famously recreated like a sort of drone shot coming into Wembley Stadium, right, as Queen were on stage. And they did it all with CGI. But I looked at it and went, that was actually my view on the day. And the reason it came about was this. So London was like absolutely packed with traffic that day. And so I was instructed to go to Battersea Heliport. And I was going to fly with Bowie in a helicopter into Wembley Stadium. And, you know, whereas, as say, Bowie had been a gentleman up to that point, he was terrified of flying. So on that day, he was a complete diva. And we got in the helicopter And you know, I had a Brownie camera with me, and I actually got the film developed like just a couple of years ago. And I remembered that I had taken some photos, and I found a few shots. They're not great, unfortunately, but they're
great. If they're shots of that, they're great.
So you know, my memory was him peering out the window, like with a hat pulled down over his face, chain smoking, which upset the pilot because you're not supposed to smoke. But he was going, "When do we get there? Are there any pylons in the way? Any tall buildings? Where are we going to land?" You know, he was like just being completely agitated.
There wasn't stage fright. It was flying. Did he have stage fright or no?
I mean, we landed and he went, "Oh, I like this bit." And he opened the door and there's like 100 paparazzi out there. And 5 minutes later, we were at the side of the stage. I mean, that bit he had down, but he just dreaded the flying, you know.
But then he changes the song literally on stage. TVC 1-5. Yeah. What was supposed to be played, or do you not remember?
I think we're going to start with Modern Love. But, you know, he switched it around and said, let's do TVC 1-5 first. And then we finished up with Heroes, which, of course, is like, you know, the ultimate Bowie anthem. And surprisingly, it sounds simple, but it's a very easy one to get wrong because, you know, some of the verses are, you know, 3 measures long. Some of them are 5 minutes, you know. So I was in a real panic that I was going to be the one to screw it up and come in with the riff in the wrong place, you know. But standing there, I mean, you know, I'm looking at Bowie's back. He's in this blue suit. He's got 100,000 people just in love with the guy, and a huge TV audience. And my fingers are just playing themselves. I mean, it was just, you know, they were on autopilot. I was just on cloud nine.
Thomas Dolby is our guest. He will be honoring the great David Bowie, his friend and mate, a little later on in the month. There's a couple of shows going on. Tell me a little bit more about Rundgren and putting this thing together. And before I even ask that, have you seen the movie yet? The movie was out. There was a screening 2 weeks ago. My wife and I put it sort of on the list 10 days ago and haven't done it yet. But I really want to do it. And I want to do it in a theater where it moves and it's awesome. And I want to have Moon the full on, you know.
Is this Moon Age Daydream you're talking about?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. No, I have not seen it yet. No, I need to go see it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to. Yeah. That's on the list. I did the moving Bowie exhibit that they've taken all over the world. They had it at the Brooklyn Museum before the plague, maybe 17, 18. And my wife and I went up and did that. And that was just, you know, the clothing, you move room to room with the headpiece on and the music moves and the stories and a lot of archival documentary things. But tell me a little bit about the Rundgren and pulling this thing together with the David Bowie tribute you all are doing.
Yes, I mean, I've never actually played with Todd. You know, in the 90s, we were both in Silicon Valley, sort of, you know, being the techno rock star types. And so we rubbed shoulders a lot back then in you know, Apple and so on. And we just over the years we said, you know, one of these days we're gonna try and collaborate together. But you know, Todd was doing a new album of collaborations. This album is out this month, and he asked me if I had anything to contribute. And I had this sort of half finished sort of B-side song that I sent his way, and he said, "Great, you know, I can work with this." And so he just, you know, we're never in the same place at the same time, but he was in his own studio and he took it to pieces and added some stuff of his own and put it back together. It's called "I'm Not Your Dog," and it's up on YouTube now with a very sort of simplistic video reference to it. So yeah, check out "I'm Not Your Dog" on YouTube. I heard a few months ago that Todd was doing a Bowie tribute tour with Adrian Belew and Scroat and various other former Bowie sidemen. And so they're touring the country and they're going to be playing at the Ramshead at the end of the month, October 31st and November 1st, I think it is. And so they asked me, you know, it's in your neck of the woods. Would you like to come down and do something? So I'm going to do a couple of songs with them on stage. I'm not doing a whole set, but I'll just sort of go down there for sound check and see what we can put together.
Well, I love when musicians and artists get together. Love all the things you're doing in Baltimore. I know you got to go teach young people how to do this. You're always great about being around town and even participating in things like this. You still love making music and getting out and being you. And I appreciate that. And thanks for making some time. And let's catch up over something that's not music or sports related, like love of Baltimore. We'll put something together on that. All right.
We'll do that. Great to see you again. Thank you.
Appreciate you. Thomas Dolby, the great Thomas Dolby. The shows you can learn more. Ramshead on Stage, about the shows. October 31st, Halloween. I've threatened to dress up as Ziggy Stardust or Aladdin's Insane, I think is what I'll be doing. I'll be going with my Goodwill friends and maybe dress that up. That's the 31st and the 1st, the Todd Rundgren tour with Adrian Belew. Find it all at Ramshead on stage.com. My thanks to Thomas Dolby. My thanks to all of our sponsors. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking Baltimore positive.